Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero.
I'm Renée de Vugelers.
And today we will discuss about the state of China's technological progress and what it entails for innovation and the economy at large. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Nawabar Sharif, an associate professor in the Division of Social Science at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Nawabar is an expert on the emergence of the innovation systems approach in academic and policymaking circles, the history of technology from a business and economics perspective, and the sociology of technology. Hello, Nawabar. How are you?
Very well, Giuseppe. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us from Hong Kong, actually. When we speak about technology progress in China, the first thing that comes to the mind is the success story of a country which has been catching up with high-end tech in only a few decades and portrays itself as a beacon for future innovations. In certain circles, such a vision coupling tech and innovation has shaped the concept of Sino-futurism, which blends with science fiction. The statistics show that internal R&D spending in China raised from 869 billion yuan in 2011 to 2.79 trillion yuan in 2021. And R&D, or research and development, is a term used to denote the investment made by a company to carry out the research and developments of its own products. This is only a metric that shows the ongoing investment leap in innovation. Nawabar, how much has China advanced in its technological progress and as a scientific powerhouse? How close they are to the frontier?
So there are two parts to that question. How much has China advanced in its technological progress and how close is it to the frontier? Let me tackle the first part of the question. China has indeed advanced a lot in terms of its technological progress. As you just mentioned, its spending on R&D has increased dramatically. So typically, when we try to understand a country's innovation progress, technological progress, we can use input and output measures. The inputs are amount of money they spend on R&D and the number of people that they have working in science and technology areas. And as you just mentioned, R&D spending has increased dramatically over the 10-year period from 2011 to 2021. And this has been accompanied by a large number of people in China working in science and technology areas. So in terms of technological inputs, China has advanced a lot over the last 10 years. Then comes the question about how close is it to the frontier? Despite it growing a lot in terms of scientific and technological prowess, I think the bigger question is that how close is it to the frontier? And here we see a lot of debate. For the first part of the question, there is no debate. It is unambiguously clear that China has continued and has started on this trajectory of increasing its R&D inputs, the number of people working in science and technology, the amount of money it spends on science and technology, not just over the last 10-year period, but more than 40 years ago, they started on this trajectory. So that is unambiguous. It is clearly measurable. However, how much bang for its buck has China received? What are the outputs it has been able to obtain that has been associated with this large amount of spending on research and development? Have those outputs been commensurate with the large amount of spending? Here we see a lot of debate, as I've just mentioned. There's a lot of controversy as to whether China is indeed getting a good bang for its buck. Some people argue, yes, they have increased their technological outputs, which are commensurate with their inputs. But other people argue, no, China is not at the frontier. And I would have to side with the latter group to say that I think China is on the way to achieving frontier status, but at the moment, it is probably not quite there yet. There's another smaller issue as to how we measure whether a country is at the frontier or not. There are many, many ways to measure technological strength and technological prowess. the inputs into science and technology being one way, the outputs that come out from science and technology, new products, number of patents is another way. And there's a quality of the products. Globally recognized brand names in science and technology is yet another way to measure how close a country is to the frontier. If we look historically, I think we would all agree that in the 19th century, it was Great Britain, following from the British Industrial Revolution, that was a country at the frontier of science and technology. In the 20th century, I think it is quite unambiguously clear that it was the United States that was at the frontier of global science and technology developments. Whether China can take the mantle away from the United States in the 21st century remains to be seen. But for the moment, I think that despite its large increase in R&D spending, it has not achieved frontier status, at least not yet. I think it's on the way, but it has not yet quite arrived.
Thank you, Nawabar. Anila, do you want to react to this first overview?
Yeah, thanks, Nawabar. So I fully appreciate what you're saying and following it for the most part here in terms of, is it close to the frontier? You're right by saying that it's not on average close to the frontier, but when you look at particular subsectors and particular areas, there it really is very close, if not really pushing the frontier here. So if you go more to a micro area in some areas, and it's not only the public sector, but it's really also private companies which are really pushing the frontier in these selected sectors. It's partly, I think, also a reflection of the way in which the progress in science and technology is going. It's very much a directed approach. So China chooses the areas where it wants science and technology to really power its growth here. And it's in those sectors that it's really pushing very fast and has been catching up very fast. And in some areas really is at the frontier here. So if you think of particularly on the engineering part, software engineering, electrical, mechanical engineering. So that engineering strength is really something where the West has a problem because of lack of skills that it can attract here. Many of the skills in that area are actually imported Chinese scholars. But it's in that area that really, and some of these sub-areas, it's really going very fast here. So I agree with you on average. It's not yet at the frontier, but in some sectors and the targeted sectors where it really puts in a lot of effort and money, it is really at the frontier and going very fast. And so did it get a bang for the bucket? I think you're right. It's spending a lot of money, but that's also one of its strengths. Also, it's also willing to lose a lot of money here. And for innovation, that's also very important. So it's also taking a lot of risks here. And that really helps it to go so fast.
I completely echo your points about its progress being patchy. As you mentioned, in some areas like engineering, it's very close to the frontier, if not exceeding and leading the world. I think renewable technology, solar technology, wind power technology is another example of where it's a global leader. But then in other areas, semiconductor, for example, it's quite far behind the frontier. So they're working very hard to try and ramp up their semiconductor capacity. And as you remember, a few years ago, a company in China, ZTE, was sanctioned by Donald Trump, the American administration. So they're working very hard. So even though the state is supporting and trying to push for the development of the semiconductor industry, they have not yet quite achieved it. But I completely agree with you. Those areas in which the state pours a lot of resources into are the areas in which they are more likely to achieve frontier status. Another example is telecommunications. For 5G and 6G wireless technology, they are leading the world in terms of technological development.
I'd like to make a comment on what has been said so far, which I fully agree with. And the comment is the following. I'd like to know where we stand right now. I mean, in that process, are the strategies that China has announced in the last couple of years, say dual circulation, shared prosperity, helpful or unhelpful? And in that regard, I want to just offer a few figures. R&D in China's percentage of GDP is around 2.2%, so which is European average. Of course, it's a very large base. It is the case for Europe too, but we're many countries, so there's perhaps more competition. I don't know whether that's a good or a bad thing. Rangel can tell us about it. But what we know is that out of that amount, only 6% is basic research. So, you know, the fact that you are at the frontier on something which is actually an application of frontier or basic research might not necessarily be helpful for you to move forward. The second thing we know is that because of common prosperity and other strategies in China, the fiscal budget is going to be pretty bloated. And we also know that two-thirds of the R&D happen to be carried out by state-owned enterprises, local government, central government, i.e. the state in whatever form. So we have targets for R&D in the five-year plan, but it seems to me, I may be wrong, that it's going to be increasingly difficult to push for this innovation in terms of having the resources to pay for it, let alone basic innovation. So that would be my question. Thank you.
Great question. So a few parts of the question. Where are we now? If we take a snapshot of China's innovation system, let's just go through a bit of the number crunch, some of the headline figures. As you mentioned, the amount of R&D that is committed as a percentage of GDP is 2.2%. China churns out over 4.2 million R&D personnel, which is the largest number of undergraduate, postgraduate, and doctoral students in science and engineering in the world. Over the period 2006 to 2018, China ranked second in the world in terms of research output as measured by the number of papers published by Chinese scientists in research journals. In 2019, China ranked second in the number of citations for papers authored by Chinese scientists. In 2019, China became the second largest origin of patents, trailing only the United States under the Patent Cooperation Treaty administered by the World Intellectual Property Office. In 2019 as well, two large telecommunication firms, in particular Huawei and ZTE, were ranked first and fifth, respectively, in worldwide ranking of top PCT, which is Patent Cooperation Treaty, patent applicants. So your question was, where are we now? If we take a snapshot, we take a picture like from a camera, and we look at the snapshot, China is very close to the frontier. Has it reached the frontier? Absolutely not. And then we come to the second part of your comment, which was that despite these headline figures, there are a lot of weaknesses in China's innovation system. As you correctly pointed out, only 6% of its R&D is on basic research. The remainder is on application. And that is something that I'm sure and I know that Chinese leaders recognize. And it's been a targeted strategy of theirs to ramp up in terms of application. Let me give you another example that echoes this push for application-based R&D. Up until the Trump administration took office in the United States, where we saw globalization at its height, China and Chinese companies use mergers and acquisitions as a deliberate strategy to move up the ladder of R&D sophistication, R&D specialization. If Chinese companies weren't able to make something or do something or didn't have the R&D capacities to move up the ladder, they went out and they simply bought their counterparts in Europe, in the United States. And there are many examples of such mergers and acquisitions. I'll just give you a few. For example, in Beijing, Automotive Industry Holdings, BAIC, acquired the intellectual property rights of Saab vehicles. Also in automotive technology, Chinese car maker Geely acquired Swedish automaker Volvo. In chemicals, CNOOC, China National Chemical Corp, acquired Italian tire maker Pirelli in 2015. So there were these raft of mergers and acquisitions by Chinese companies to quickly move up the R&D ladder. The way I conceive of it is this. If you take a look at cyclists as they are racing, you see there's a front pack, a peloton, at the front of the racing pack of cyclists. I think what China has done has quickly joined the front leading pack. Can it be the one nation that leads the race entirely? Not yet. I think, as you correctly pointed out, rather, there are extremely large number of weaknesses in China's innovation system. You pointed to the basic research. You pointed also to the fact that two-thirds of R&D is conducted by state-owned enterprises. That is absolutely right. China's R&D and innovation system has been state-led. It's been state-driven. There are a lot of advantages to that. As Hilda pointed out, you can pour immense amounts of money in. You can take risks. The state says we have the wherewithal to bet and to lose, and we don't mind losing these big bets. However, what that does, it masks a lot of weaknesses in China's innovation system. weaknesses among universities and weaknesses also among private companies. When Steve Jobs passed away, what, 10 years ago now, I believe it was, there was a lot of debate in China. Conclusions that came out of that debate was that so long as we have a centralized planned economy, we are not going to have a Steve Jobs, because that is antithetical to the spirit of innovation. Innovation means creativity, thinking crazy ideas, going against the norms, going against the status quo. When you have a centralized communist party ruling your country, it becomes very constraining in certain respects to go against the norms, to think outside of the box. And this recent crackdown that we have seen in China in a number of industries, not least tech industries, just reinforces that. That no matter how creative an individual may be in China, they too can and will be reined in by the state if the state so desires.
No, but I wanted to chime in on the crackdown that you just mentioned, because I think it's worth for our listeners to go a little bit deeper. We have touched the and followed the whole story about the regulatory crackdown, especially on the tech industry here at the Sound of Economics. So you definitely point out a negative role of that crackdown. So it would be good to perhaps focus a little bit more into the consequences of such crackdown. And for example, also the regulatory role of the state in the economy that you just mentioned. But on the other hand, you know, tell us also a little bit more about the state-owned enterprises' role on China's R&D. You mentioned as well the fact that the state is pouring a lot of money and putting a lot of risks on that. So there is a little bit of a double story over there, if I understand correctly. On one hand, the creativity could be hampered by such strings from the state. But on the other hand, you have a state who is pouring, let's say, considerably a huge amount of money comparing to any Western state, sometimes with less strings attached than the Western public funding when it comes to R&D. So maybe you can explain a little bit better how this ecosystem works.
Yes, that's a good contradiction that you point out, that on the one hand, the Chinese state is trying to promote innovation, yet it tries to curtail and control innovation when it deems that activity to be going out of hand. And I think what you mentioned, Giuseppe, is precisely it, that they want to promote innovation to the limits which they feel and they define as being reasonable. And now here, I think, is a critical point, that technological superiority, technological dominance, technological development, technological prowess is one piece of the puzzle in China. It is a very important piece of the puzzle. It's a very important part of the puzzle, but it's not everything. For the Chinese Communist Party to retain its legitimacy and to remain in power, it has to demonstrate its sympathy for the large masses of population, hence the term common prosperity. And my interpretation of the crackdown on tech companies is that they were contravening this article of faith, which is they coin as being common prosperity. And once these tech companies became so big and threatened to break this social contract of common prosperity, allowing the whole nation as a unit to be uplifted, then the Chinese regulators felt that they needed to step in and crack down. So despite their own push, as we've already established, to promote science and technology by pouring so many resources into it, so much money into it, they too know that there are limits to which they can push this area of development. And once those limits are reached, they are never afraid of cracking down and doing what it takes to rein in these competitive market animal forces that threaten to just go out on a limb. So they will take down IPOs one day before the company is meant to list on the stock market. They will crack down on the largest corporations. They will talk to the leaders of these tech giants in China and tell them that they have to change their ways, because they know that even more important than technological development, than technological dominance, is this idea that the whole nation has to be uplifted somewhat uniformly. And if that social contract of common prosperity is broken, then everything else underneath it crumbles. So they're playing a balancing act, if you would like. They're juggling a lot of balls, and they're trying to keep all these balls in the air at the same time. And sometimes some balls are thrown higher and other balls are thrown not so high.
Yeah, so can I come in? So my strategy is usually never to underestimate the others here. So I would tend to be a bit more careful about the analysis of the influence of the state and how negative that is for China here. In general, it's a very blurred picture anyway, the difference between public and private here. But I think the private sector is very important driver for the rise of science and technology for China here. And of course, the question is, to which extent is this a good blend between public and private that we are seeing here? And in the digital sector, indeed, there is a lot of potential crackdown and influence of the public sector here. But let me remind you that also in Europe and in the West, there is a lot of influence and also a influence of the public sector in terms of trying to rein in any too strong power from the private sector here with competition policy interventions as well here. So in that respect, it's not necessarily because there is what you call a crackdown or an influence of the public sector that that's not necessarily negative, and negative even for science and technology progress here. Because if it's raining down on too much influence from dominant sectors or dominant companies here, it may actually unleash the entrepreneurial spirits that otherwise would be cracked down here. So in that respect, it all depends a bit on what the objective is of the intervention here. If the crackdown, of course, is simply to make sure that these companies will align with the party's interest, that's of course something else. But if it's more in terms of trying to make sure that monopoly powers are not being misused, then this kind of crackdown is actually just a reflection of a Chinese version of finding a good mix between public and private interactions here. But if I can push you a bit further in terms of what you also mentioned in your intervention, was perhaps this lack of openness or this reduction in openness here, so that Chinese companies are less going outside acquiring other Western companies. So is this reduction in openness, is this something because to some extent, they no longer need to take over because they've been catching up in a number of areas here. Also, the access to markets may be becoming less important here. Is that what's driving behind? Or is it really more also a more emphasis from the public sector in terms of trying to rein in on these and emphasizing more the indigenous dimension of innovation and favoring more local companies and local markets?
Yeah, that was fantastic comments. Just first, I just wanted to echo what you said about the strong role played by the state in even Western countries. I completely agree with you that even in Western Europe and even in a North American context, the state does play a very strong role. And if we look at the role that the United States government played after the Second World War, it was a very strong role to rebuild the country, rebuild the economy. A lot of military R&D was conducted from where we got the radar, GPS, the internet, and so forth. That spilled over from the military sector into the civilian sector. So I completely agree with you that China is not alone, and it's not alone in history in particular, as having a strong state hand being playing a role in R&D activities. So that's the first part I wanted to echo. The second part of your question was, why has this going out been curtailed? I think it has not been curtailed from the Chinese side. I think what's happened is that a lot of Western countries, governments and companies are now wary of being bought out by China. As you've seen in Australia, as you've seen in Germany, as you've seen in the United States, the state of those countries starts to intervene much more actively to try and screen these possible mergers and acquisitions. KUKA of Germany was bought out by Midea in China. And that created a lot of newspaper headlines, a lot of debate about when is this going to end? How many companies will China need to buy of its Western counterparts before they stop? And the same thing happened in Australia, the same thing happened in Canada, and also in the United States. And I think the reason why it stopped is A, because of wariness from the recipient countries of China's influence and interventionist nature, and B, also because of this global sort of swing towards deglobalization, if you want. And that goes beyond China. It goes beyond just two countries. It's this global. We had this era of decades of interconnectedness, high globalization, and now the pendulum is swinging the other way. And that too has played a role as countries become a little bit more critical and a little bit more hands-off and wary of what they need to do.
So what's your opinion on that in the sense of, are they right to be more wary, or is this really also that policy choice of our size? Are we killing the cake that we can jointly share?
No, I think each country has the prerogative and has a choice to be wary or not of, foreign purchases. My own analysis is that China, unlike its Western counterparts, does not have a strong history of using these mergers and acquisitions, using these technologies, let's just say for bad purposes, for want of a better word, for colonization, for beginning wars, for invading other countries. And, you know, this is the forefront of the news headlines today, where one country has invaded another. Does China have a strong history of that? Not so much. So in that sense, if we look at the bigger picture, are these mergers and acquisitions likely to be bad in the sense that China is going to use these mergers and acquisitions to invade another country, to begin a war, to take human lives? Probably not. So in the bigger picture, if you look at the bigger scheme of things, these countries may be a little bit too wary and too skeptical and circumspect of Chinese intervention. But at the same time, at a micro level, they do have their own good reasons. They don't want their sectors, their telecommunication sector, their natural resources sectors to be taken over by a foreign country and foreign companies. So it's difficult because each country has different agendas. The Canada's agenda is different from Australia's. Australia's is different from Germany's. So it's difficult to generalize in that sense. But I think that it's also a symptom of this era of deglobalization that we're in that I've mentioned.
Yes, I like to add to that. It's a very interesting conversation, especially if we focus on what this M&A brings in terms of innovation for China. So I guess the issue here in terms of whether the West, and in particular Europe, given Bruegel's special interest, is whether the West is right or wrong, and whether also China is bringing a lot of innovation out of Europe to then, you know, develop, and whether we could do the same. And that's where the hot potato lies, that we can't do the same. I mean, if China is really at the front line, as Reinhilde was saying, of certain technologies, it wouldn't be too bad for us to actually be able to access and acquire. The reality of things is that not only are those highly innovative sectors totally close to foreign competition, but also others. So, you know, in a way, we don't even have to perhaps go beyond explaining our fear, but actually just explaining the lack of reciprocity. And you could even stop there. But beyond that, what is very clear in the data is that first, China is buying less. But I would argue, at least for Europe, that the reason is not so much Europe blocking the deals. And let me explain you why. It's because actually, when you look at the composition of the M&A deals from China into Europe during the last 4 years, from 2018 onwards, the focus has been, yes, there are fewer deals. They're actually more in number. So they're smaller, below the radar. And guess what? They're mostly high-value deals, meaning robotics, industrial technology. You know, that's where they are focusing. So if it were as simple as we want to buy and not so much we want to extract the high-end and the technology, you wouldn't see that pattern. Still, as Reinhilde, and I guess we should agree, because supposedly we're all, you know, orthodox economists believing in trade and globalization. So, you know, there's no harm in that, in as far as we can continue to innovate, yeah, and substitute the innovation that is taken away. And that's a key question, in fact. But for that to be true, it would also be quite nice to be able to access the other side's innovation. In that way, it wouldn't be a problem because you take your leave, and then, you know, both kind of move up the ladder. But I think the fact that one market is pretty close makes that very difficult. So it is indeed, in my opinion, quite related. So that's all.
Yeah, no, I think that's a key point, that the lack of reciprocity is a source of unease among the Western counterpart, on the part of any counterpart, because as you mentioned, the closure of this reciprocity means that there isn't any possibility of give and take, of them taking some areas of innovative activity and we growing in another area. And I think that this is one area of concern that a lot of people level at China, rightly, because I think from China's perspective, they've always wanted to focus on their economy first and foremost. If anything, they are selfish, as some would say rightly so, to try and improve their own economy, improve their own companies, and raise the level of indigenous technology. So they don't allow the foreign competitors to come in. They don't allow Facebook and Google and all these big players to come in and dominate because they want to nurture their own. Now, is that a right thing to do from a Chinese government perspective, or is it wrong? That's a different question. But the issue of reciprocity is definitely a real issue that blocks a lot of agreements and sort of this win-win situation from emerging. I agree with that.
Yeah, perhaps I can add to that. So because we're talking about science and technology, so this is really an area where win-win is really essential here. So this is, we're talking about jointly creating new knowledge that then everybody can exploit in their own way with applications for which they can find commercial returns to. And so this notion of spillovers are always two-way. And so the best way to make sure that we all benefit from it is making sure that the spillovers keep on flowing here. But at the same time, also making sure that everybody can appropriate the returns from their specific use of that knowledge here. And that's why we have like the patent system as well here. So finding that good balance into sharing knowledge, but at the same time also giving enough incentives to appropriate. That's a delicate balance. And the question is, to which extent can China join that kind of balance in a positive way so that we actually create a win-win here? And to me, what's a very important element in making sure that you get that balance is the mobility of people, of researchers here. And so that's why initially the fact that China was also sending out a lot of Chinese scholars and researchers internationally and those returning and vice versa created a lot of mobility on the floor. And that, I think, was a very good mechanism for making sure that that openness was going on. So to which extent, Nabar, do you see that that mobility of people, of researchers, of individuals within companies, but also across countries in general, is that also something that's in regress here? And would that also be something that soon as these communities tend to become much more isolated, would actually lose a lot of that spillover potential?
I definitely do agree and believe that the high period for interaction, for mixing, for talent mobility has passed us in the same way that the high period for globalization has passed us. The pendulum is definitely swinging the other way. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, China had a number of schemes, a talent scheme, attraction scheme for attracting ethnic Chinese citizens back from Europe, back from the United States to come back to mainland China to develop their labs, to work in the universities, and so forth. So talent mobility, people mobility was at a high point up until about 5 years ago. And in the most recent five-year period, I think that has been de-escalating and it has been in regress. And I think that does impact the development of China's innovation system. Going back to the other point that you made about whether it's a win-win situation, how to make that balance between appropriation of benefits versus technological developments, I think that the key point to remember here is that creating an innovation system is not something that can take place overnight. Creating an innovation system requires time, requires a lot of ingredients, like a tasteful dish that you make. A lot of ingredients go into making the dish tasty. So when we're talking about China's innovation system, we have to remember that we also talked about the fact that they do very little basic research and a lot of applied research. What that points to is that I think China understands that these tools that they are using to climb up the ladder are short-term tools. And I think Western Europe would do well to recognize that. Instead of seeing these mergers and acquisitions as a threat, they should realize that we are in the position that we are because of the strength of our innovation system. If China is coming to purchase our companies or try and attract our researchers, that is not necessarily a bad thing. Let's continue to ensure that we are ahead of the game. And that China continues to woo our companies, to woo our people, rather than just closing it off. Because as you rightly pointed, I think the long-term way in which humanity and the world can develop is if we continue prospering and we continue to find these win-win situations. So instead of Western Europe finding China to be a threat, I think they should be slightly proud that they are being wooed by this outsider. And they should focus on trying to galvanize the strengths that made China look towards Europe to purchase European companies and to attract European researchers.
And Noabar, I think that this brings us somehow towards the conclusion of our conversation, because your statement encapsulate a little bit the, what Renilde was also saying about what is this all about? I mean, what innovation and technology is all about when, you know, competition on one hand, like positive competition or like seeing competition as a positive element, as a drive for innovating even more. It's something that should push and should drive the global competition, in this case, between China and the rest of the world, rather than the situation we seem to see more and more in terms of reaction, in terms of like closing down on both sides, you know, on one side for fear, on the other side for other reasons and so on. So I think we are going towards the end of this episode because we don't have so much more time to allocate for our listeners, but perhaps just a final round. I would like also to hear from Renilde and Alicia, a final round of reflections on what Noabar has been telling us so far, and then giving the word to Noabar for a last wrap up, and then we are going to close the episode.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation here. So my last remarks would be in terms of, we should not be seeing this as a race. We should be seeing this as a win-win game here. And let's return to that.
Thank you, Rahil. Thank you, Nabuhar. I want to share very quickly, first time I met Nabuhar many years ago, he was giving a seminar on why China would become a major source of innovation globally, and that was the state, size, and you know, he compared with the US. And indeed, his words were wise, because we've seen that happening. But he also warned about the use of that ability to innovate for purposes other than, Rahil, that you just said it, that creating those spillovers. And I think that's the risk we are encountering now. I think we as Europeans, the answer, and Nabuhar told us loud and clear, is not to fear, but to do. So we need to do. We need to basically realize that we do have companies that are innovative. Otherwise, nobody would want to buy them. We have certainly researchers and who are worth the word. Otherwise, we would see them leaving. And I think the whole point here is, and going back to what Nabuhar said, we probably not yet have the fully integrated single market we need to compete in terms of size, which is one of the key issues here, and a state that perhaps, you know, looks beyond the borders, i.e. bigger role at the European level to really coordinate this innovation. So I think we should learn from China, but also realize that we do have our abilities as well. And Nabuhar has reminded us of that. So I thank him for that.
Yeah, so I just want to echo what Alicia and Reinhalder said. China is a $17 trillion economy. It's the second biggest economy. So the United States is $23 trillion. If China does become the second biggest player in R&D, it shouldn't come as a surprise necessarily. But I echo Alicia completely that the European economies, even though they are smaller, the biggest European economy is Germany, $4.2 trillion. Even though these economies are significantly smaller, they together have a heft that can be comparable to China's. Even if they are not together and they work individually, we see a great deal of technological prowess from the Scandinavian economies of Denmark and Sweden and Norway, not to mention Western Europe. And these, by comparison, are very small economies compared to China. Italy is 2 trillion, Spain is 1.5 trillion. I just said China is 17 trillion. So if China is coming to Italy, Spain, Germany, United Kingdom, and France, and trying to woo researchers, trying to attract their companies to invest in China, or China is merging with or trying to acquire these companies, I think that's a good sign. That's an excellent sign. That is a signal that Europe should continue to do what they are doing. They are on the right path. And it's even more commendable because, as I mentioned, comparatively speaking, they're so small. China being the second most dominant player in R&D and technology, or the first most dominant, not really a surprise. It's commensurate with their size. They are indeed a giant. But Western Europe, I think what they can do is to continue these specific areas of specific technologies, be it telecommunications, automation, industrial robots, whatever those technologies may be, these specific sectors in which they do have leadership roles, to continue to strive forward, move forward. And I think that's the only way that we're going to see a win-win situation across the globe.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nuabar, for those wise words. And unfortunately, I have to cut the discussion because we could discuss for much longer, but we don't have so much time anymore. But we are definitely coming back to this topic here at The Sound of Economics. We are following very closely, so stay tuned for more episodes. And obviously, this brings us to the end of this episode, which was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Now, Abar, Alicia, Renilde, thanks a lot for joining this conversation. And thanks to our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.